Hi, my name is Saul, and this is the Story of London podcast. Currently, we're on the third episode covering the events of June 1381 and the Peasants' Revolt. Whereas normally I do try and summarise what happened in previous episodes so each chapter can stand alone, there is so much to get through in this chapter. All I can say is to fully understand the content of what you're about to hear, you do need to have listened to the previous one or two. My apologies. Anyway, without further ado, let's finish this story. Welcome then to chapter 134 of the Story of London. Behold the Wretched Sons. On the night of June 14th, 1381, in the small hours, a meeting was held in the Tower of London. The 14-year-old King of England, Richard II, was facing a crisis. The armed insurrection that had started across Essex and Kent had now spread across England, and he was trapped in London with its most potent elements. For all the imagery you have of wild ploughmen of the countryside descending upon the city, the main body and leaders of this group had been the bedrock of the rural communities, the yeomen of England, Middle England. And they had not fallen upon the city in a wave of rapine and plunder. They had displayed some kind of strong discipline, and it had made it so the targets so far of the communal violence and deaths had all been political ones. The rebellion had damaged or destroyed the Palace of Lambeth, south of the River Thames, along with the homes of the jurors and judges within Southwark who worked for the Marshalsea. The mobs had plundered and burned the headquarters of the Order of the Knights of St. John in Clerkenwell and destroyed the leader of that group's manor in Highbury. The crowds had thrown open the gates of Marshalsea Prison, the Fleet Prison, and had attacked a region now synonymous with the growing legal system in the country, the Temple. Here at Temple, they had systematically destroyed court records and legal documents, creating a grand bonfire in Fleet Street before going on and systematically obliterating the great palace of the Savoy. On top of this, they had besieged the king in his fortress, preventing supplies coming into the great and the good locked away with him inside. The king was needing a solution. Despite the risks, the king's ongoing policy to deal with it all seemed to have been a smart one. Play for time, solve the crisis quickly, promise and agree to everything. Take that and pardon everyone. Hopefully the mobs would go home. The various rebel bands seemed to believe the king was their only hope, so he simply gave them what they wished to hear. The plan was, when things had calmed down and the king had regained control, then the royal court could deal with this crisis on their own terms. What must be understood is that there was not one large body of rebels in London during the wee hours of June the 14th. There were many, with no centralised command. We had two separate group of rebels from Kent, those who'd arrived with Wat Tyler, plus those who'd left ahead of him and had been responsible for the attack on Lambeth Palace. You had the residents of Southwark who had aided this group and then directed it towards the Marshalsea and other places. You had two groups of rebels from Essex, those who were gathering in Mile End and those who arrived later from Brentwood and made short work of the buildings in Clerkenwell. And you now had joining them a large body of Londoners who were happily going along with the riot and who had directed the crowds towards the Fleet Prison, the Temple and the Savoy. So the real question Richard II had as dawn approached was really, who does he talk to? The decision had been made to try to negotiate with the original instigators of this entire rebellion, the rebels from Essex. And this was why early the next morning the king and many of the assembled lords beside him decided to leave the safety of the tower, travel north through the region known as Portsoken, and arrive at Mile End. But there was a lot going on that morning. As the great clock tower of Westminster tolled the hours upon the huge bell known as the Edward, and its sound resounded across the city, There were many moving parts in this city, several factions all acting at the same time. We know that as the king was about to make his way out of the tower, another group on the other side of the city swung into action. The crowds that had attacked the Savoy now set out towards Westminster. Along the way, they burned the house of Sir John Butterwick, the under-sheriff of Middlesey. They also broke open the jail at Westminster and freed its inmates. To the residents of Westminster town, the town that surrounded the royal court and the Holy Abbey, it seemed as if the fury of the mob was about to descend upon them. But, having done this, the crowd seemed satisfied with these simple achievements. They made no attempt to storm the complex of governmental and ecclesiastical buildings. Again, there was a discipline being shown here. Westminster itself lay vulnerable to the mobs, but they did not strike. Rather, they returned to the city via Holborn, where they burned the tenement of one Simon Hostler and broke open the prison at Newgate. This was the fourth London prison to be broken open during the Great Uprising, and it does suggest a degree of collusion between the rebels and the criminal underclass of the city. But while this was going on in London's West End, across the city on the East End, the king was heading north. According to one source, he was accompanied by his mother and half-brothers, several of the noble magnates and knights, and the mayor and other Londoners, as he made his way through crowded streets to Mile End. The journey was eventful, as the mob surrounded them. Along the way, the king was accosted by a London goldsmith called Thomas Farringdon. Quote, "There he spoke to the king to be permitted to legally enter a tenement in London which Richard Weston had seized from him, and said that if the king did not wish to recognise his legal title to the same tenement, that he would take possession of it on his own authority," unquote. The goldsmith, as supposedly involved in the attacks of the Savoy and several other buildings, he was clearly one of the mob, and here he was asking for the king to intervene in his own personal private property dispute. Diplomatically, King Richard promised him justice and rode on. A short while later, while the party was still relatively close to Aldgate, the bridle of Nicholas Brembe's horse was grabbed by one of the crowd, a Londoner called William Truman, and his excuse for grabbing the bridle was that he wanted to, quote, "reprove him about injuries made to him at the time of his mayoralty," unquote. So there's a Londoner complaining about when Brembe was mayor. We think he just rode on, ignoring it. But Truman wasn't done with Brembe. Not yet. But it's clear that the crowd was wild, their tempers were up, and it was a lively journey. While we have conflicting accounts of what exactly happened, it is probable at this point that the king's mother and his family and some of the knights turned back. One writer at the time said, quote, "But the knights who should have gone with the king completely lost their courage and showed, sad to say, no spirit whatsoever. They seemed struck by womanly fears," unquote. Were the womanly fears the fear of the king's mother, the Princess of Wales? They could well have been. Be that as it may, this large mob of angry people was no place for the royal family. The young king pressed on along the road with a smaller retinue at this point. We could argue he couldn't really turn back himself. The atmosphere was too wild, too dangerous. He had the smaller party, which, given one source says the knights had turned back with the royal party, it was probably the Londoners, including Brembe and others, who were with him when he finally reached Mile End. And there he found several hundred rebels assembled to meet him. Most of them had come from Essex, but their spokesman remains totally unknown to us. Certainly Wat Tyler is not mentioned in this group. The rebels greeted the king courteously, but stressed the long-running grievances which had started this entire rebellion. Quote, "When they had arrived at the rendezvous, the commons complained to the king about their intolerable servitude and heavy oppressions, which they neither could nor would sustain any longer," unquote. At the end of the day, the rebels just made two requests of the young king. The first was that they should be able to deal with those whom they called the traitors, the members of the royal court they felt had led the young king astray. King Richard replied, very diplomatically, that they could have the heads of such traitors, as they had been judged by law. The young king was not throwing his chancellor and main royal officials under the bus here. He basically said he'd judge them if the law found them guilty. It's a concession, sure, but it's not a betrayal. Mostly, however, the crowd asked for the abolition of serfdom and for a standard rent of land of 4 pence an acre. And Richard, whether genuinely or otherwise, gave in to all their demands. There at Mile End, he had it proclaimed that he would confirm and grant that they would be free. And as a result of this, he ordered charters of manumission to be drawn up and issued then and there. That he had them there to be able to be issued does suggest he'd turned up to this meeting prepared. Ultimately, this was a PR stunt, organised before he left and carried out by the King and those who remained with him. The King's move was greeted with cheers. It's often overlooked that actually this strategy did work to a degree. One of the most important immediate consequences of the concessions of the charters was to break up the rebel bands in London. In spite of all their common aims, the rebels had at no point coalesced into a single force accepting the orders of one united leadership. And it's most likely that they had was simply a loose confederation of different contingents. The bulk of the men of Essex and Hertfordshire appeared to have accepted the charters and began to withdraw from London. This was a victory. The policy of conciliation was working. Mollify the rebels and send them home. But while this was a large group, it was not all the groups. And while the King was doing this, just to the south of him, something terrible happened. The high-minded aspirations to freedom and liberty we have heard expressed by the rebels at Mile End also came attached with their desire to simply liquidate royal councillors, members of the judiciary associated with the collection and enforcement of the poll tax. Those kind of people. They're all marked for death. Now, while a number of local officials of the Crown were murdered in the opening days of the revolt, the principal targets of the crowd's rage were all basically seeking security in the King's company, and they'd remained with him in the Tower. When Richard had set out for Mile End, many of these officials stayed behind because it was way too risky to venture out into the mob. But while the King was away at Mile End, issuing his charters to break up the mob from Essex, somehow, the Tower of London was breached. There are conflicting details about what happened and how the rebels entered the Tower. One source claimed that the entry was made by those men, supposedly led by Wat Tyler, who had returned from the meeting of the King at Mile End. But all the other sources said it was a separate rebel group which had remained behind on Tower Hill when the King had gone north. The chronology of both the attack on the Tower and the subsequent massacres remain hazy. We're not even sure how they got in. We're fairly sure there was no violence required to break into the Tower of London. Quote, while this charter was being granted, behold, the wretched sons who remained near the Tower drew forth the Archbishop and his said companions and summoned them to their deaths, all without the use of any aggression or force, sword or arrow, but only by means of threatening words and disorderly shouts, unquote. According to this version, it appears that the mob simply intimidated their way in, and the gates were simply opened to them. There is another possible explanation, not written down, but it is highly possible. If indeed the account that said the King's mother and his half-brothers and other members of the royal family had travelled with the young 14-year-old out to Mile End and then turned back halfway, it could be that upon their arrival back at the Tower, when the gates were opened for them, that the mob had, well, using threatening words and disorderly shouts, forced their way in. Whatever was the exact case, once inside, the rebels plundered and pillaged freely. In the privy wardrobe, they took away coats of mail, helmets, and the standards bearing the royal arms and those of St. George. Quote, for who would ever have believed that such rustics, and most inferior ones at that, would dare to enter the chamber of the King and of his mother with their filthy sticks, and undeterred by any of the soldiers, to stroke and lay their uncouth and sordid hands on the beards of several most noble knights. Moreover, they conversed familiarly with the soldiers, asking them to be faithful to the Ribalds and friendly in the future, unquote. The imagery we have are a surprised bunch of insurrectionists suddenly finding themselves in the enemy headquarters, going around stroking beards and making jokes. But this familiarity took a darker tone soon after. Quote, after the rebels had done all these things and had gained access singly and in groups to the rooms in the tower, they arrogantly lay and sat on the king's bed while joking, and several asked the king's mother to kiss them. But, marvellous to relate, the many knights and squires present dared not resist any of these unseemly deeds, nor raise their hands in opposition, nor keep the rebels quiet by means of secret words. The rebels, who had formerly belonged to the most lowly condition of serf, went in and out like lords, and switchards set themselves above soldiers, although not knights but rustics, unquote. In another account, it was added, quote, also, these gluttons entered into the princess's chamber, break her bed, whereby she was so afraid that she swooned. And there she was taken up by her servants and borne to the waterside and put into a barge and covered, and so conveyed to the place called the Queen's Wardrobe. And there she was all that day and night like a woman half dead, till she was comforted by the king, her son, as ye shall hear hereafter, unquote. This aggressive, lascivious humour shown by the rebels towards Princess Joan and her daughter, the Duchess of Brittany, actually, as creepy and as intimidating as it is, belied a far darker purpose to the invasion of the tower. This crowd was here for blood, and the principal target of this group was the Chancellor of England and Archbishop of Canterbury, the former Bishop of London, Simon of Sudbury. Again, there are conflicting accounts about what exactly happened. One says, quote, but Sudbury did not seem to be seeking martyrdom in the manner of Thomas Becket, as he made a bid to escape the tower through its water gate, only to be foiled by the vigilance of a woman who noticed him, unquote. Another account, however, says that the mob moved, quote, with devilish instinct and in a great throng, with an enormous cry. Finding there one of the archbishop's servants, they furiously asked him to lead them to the place in which the pious father, whom they called the traitor, was hiding. This servant, not daring to disobey the order, led the rebels to the chapel, where after celebrating Mass and receiving Holy Communion, the archbishop was busy at his prayers, unquote. Whatever the exact sequence of how they found him, the accounts go on to say, quote, on seeing him, those limbs of Satan laid their impious hands on him and tore him from the chapel, paying no respect to the sanctity of the place or its holy altars, nor the image of the cross at the top of the crozier, nor even to the sacrament which the priest held before him. Worse than those demons who fear Christ's sacraments and flee from them, they disregarded the presence of the Saviour and dragged the archbishop along the passages by his arm and hood to their fellows outside the gates on Tower Hill, unquote. Whatever the case of the circumstances of how the archbishop was found, Sudbury was clearly in the hands of the mob now, and was dragged outside of the walls, and found himself standing before a baying crowd. Quote, when he arrived there, a most horrible shouting broke out, not like the clamour normally produced by men, but a sort of which enormously exceeded all human noise, which can only be compared to the wailings of the inhabitants of hell. The archbishop, as we said, stood there amongst a crowd, surrounded by thousands of ruffians, and saw many of their swords drawn about his head to threaten him with death, unquote. Now, standard accounts of what followed allow Simon Sudbury to be painted as coming out with those amazing, awesome one-liners that all martyrs seem to be able to come out with before they meet their fate. But whatever the exact sequence of what was said, he was attacked. One source says, quote, he was first struck severely, but not fatally, in the neck. He put his hand up to the wound and said, ah, this is the hand of God, as he did not move his hand from the place of sorrow. The second blow cut off the top of his fingers, as well as severing part of the arteries. But the archbishop did not die, and only on the eighth blow, wretchedly wounded in the neck and on the head, did he complete what we believe is worthy to be called his martyrdom. His body lay there unburied throughout the whole of that Friday, and the next day too. No one dared bury it for fear of the insane mob raging everywhere, unquote. The gruesome murder of the Chancellor of England, his head being hacked off, was simply the start. From within the Tower, more and more victims were removed. The other victims, Sir Robert Hales, the Royal Treasurer, John Legge, a ducal surgeon, Friar William Appleton, who was linked to John of Gaunt, and Richard Summoner of Stepney, a tax collector from Middlesex, were also dragged out before the baying mob, and to the exultation of all, also had their heads removed at the same spot on Tower Hill. The rebels celebrated the death, placing the severed heads on poles, and began a monstrous procession, and decorated the head of Sir Archbishop Sudbury by placing a scarlet cap upon it and fixing it there with a nail through the skull. And yet, some within the Tower of London did escape. And the most crucial name of those who avoided the mob was the Earl of Derby, the son of John of Gaunt, a young man known as Henry of Bolingbroke. He was in the Tower and would have died had the mob discovered him. But somehow he is able to escape the carnage, and how, no one rightfully knows. But there is from this time a story that he was saved by one John Ferrer, who was one of the mob who invaded the Tower. Who was John Ferrer? Well, we don't know, but there is a lot of conjecture. And actually, we kind of encountered him nearly last chapter. See, last episode, I mentioned a Joanna Ferrer, the woman who had supposedly stole £1,000 worth of silver out of the burning palace of Savoy before jumping in a boat, sailing to Southwark, and divvying it up. She and John were married. Now, later court records state that Joan and Joanna were leaders of the mob from Kent. True or not, the name of John Ferrer has caused a small but lively cul-de-sac of historical inquiry. He is listed as John Ferrer of Southwark, but several historians make the link to suggest he may have been John Ferrer of Rochester. Now, John Ferrer of Rochester and his wife Joanna could well have been in the King's Bench prison for homicide at the time the revolt came in and were released during the riots, and they had joined in the attacks on the Savoy. He does seem to be named as one of the principal leaders of the rebellion. He is named in several documents as being active amongst the rebels, and he certainly is said to be one of the people who, well, chopped off the heads of the Archbishop of Canterbury. It could be that he and his wife may have indeed saved the 14-year-old Henry of Bolingbroke that day, and in return for that deed gained himself a pardon. We'll never know for sure, but it's a heck of a story. Whatever the case, back in the Tower of London, there was a bloodbath, and at this, and without so many of the Essex contingent who were now beginning to leave, the iron discipline, which had held the mobs restrained, does seem to have finally snapped. That Friday afternoon, the bloodlust of the city was up. The King could not return to the Tower. He was busy issuing pardons over in Mile End. And all around him, within the walls of the city, now began the chaos. The centre was gone. Mere anarchy was loosed upon the streets of London. Any semblance of political purpose seems to have been swept away. We begin to see this strange effect. As the heads of the members of the royal court were being carried along on poles, like the ripples of a wave, all semblance of law and order and even mob discipline just break. The breakdown of law and order allowed people to pursue private quarrels and vendettas. One of the leaders of the Kentish rebels, Thomas Raven, went to the house of the grocer, Reginald Allen, and forced him to hand over a bond which recorded Raven's debt to him. Raven may have come from Southwark, it's one of those ambiguous origins. Meanwhile, Paul Salisbury, the son of the grocer Sir Thomas Salisbury, used the opportunity of the breakdown of law and order to pursue his grievance against two other grocers, William Barrett and Hugh Fastoff, both of whom were aldermen that year. These two men had leases of two of his father's properties in London. That Friday, with his servant and a hired group of ruffians, young Paul went to the house of William Barrett, broke down the door and drove out Barrett, his wife and their servants. This family was forced to stand in the street outside of the house, and after Barrett's wife had been made to kneel and beg for a long time, they had to hand over the deeds by which Thomas had issued the house to them in the first place. Paul Salisbury then went on to the house of Hugh Fastoff by the Tower in Thames Street. Fastoff had married Joan, a kinswoman of Paul, and Paul was intent on regaining from her and from her husband that house in Thames Street. Hugh Fastoff was not present, so Paul Salisbury assaulted his wife Joan, seized the indenture by which his father had conveyed the property, and then he and his henchmen drank 6 casks of ale and a load of wine and threatened to behead Fastoff if they found him there. Meanwhile, that man, William Truman, who had seized the bridle of Nicholas Brembe's horse as he was going towards Mile End, he was not done. The records state that, quote, the same William Truman afterwards, on the same Friday, together with one captain of said wrongdoers, so insurging and other wrongdoers, came to the house of said Nicholas Brembe at Le Royal in London, and made a great affray upon the same Nicholas there by power of the said captain and the other aforesaid wrongdoers, and on several occasions disquieted and threatened him there and his whole household. Constraining the same Nicholas then and there, on account of fear of these threats and for avoiding greater danger, to pay the same William Truman 5 marks, unquote. Brembe seemed determined to defend his property, but was willing to pay off Truman and the rebels to avoid fighting and an attack upon it. There could have been a very good reason for this, but we'll come back to that. But as the city descended into lawlessness, I have to draw your attention to the case of one man and his personal campaign of destruction upon the city. The man called Walter at Kay. Walter was a Londoner. He lived in Wood Street, just off Cheapside. He was also a brewer. And during the whole revolt, while others were busy beheading the Archbishop of Canterbury, here was Walter, and according to a writ sent afterwards, he was, quote, leading a company of other malefactors, and came to a house of Andrew Vernon, a brewer, at Paul's Wharf, London, on the said Friday. Walter criminally and treasonably forced his way into the said house and threatened to kill Andrew and destroy his house unless the latter paid a fine to him. In face of these threats and in fear of his life, Andrew paid a fine of 3 shillings and 4 pence, which Walter received despite its criminal and treasonable form, unquote. In a city where people are now pursuing their own vengeance, what Walter's doing seems completely normal. But he was only getting started. Later, it is said that he, quote, was one of the principal malefactors in that, together with many other rebels unknown to the jurors, he came to the London Guildhall in the parish of St. Lawrence, Old Jury. On the Friday, Walter criminally and treasonably brought fire with him in order to burn the Guildhall and a certain book called Le Jubilee, unquote. Somehow, he stopped from burning down the Guildhall, but he wasn't done yet, because later documents state, quote, moreover, on that same Friday, Walter was present with the said malefactors when the King's Compter in Milk Street was broken into and despoiled, and he performed many other illegal actions against the peace, and for this reason, he later fled, unquote. Now, included in the testimony against him about that attack on the King's Compter in Milk Street, it says, quote, Walter was one of the chief malefactors in breaking into and despoiling the Compter and the chests therein. He was looking for a book concerning the constitutions of the City of London called Le Jubilee in order to burn it if he could find it, unquote. And here we meet for the first time the book that I'm using as a symbolic heart of all these chapters, The Jubilee. A book so detested that during the carnage of the day, one man and a bunch of companions stalked the streets of London looking to destroy it, seeking to burn Le Jubilee. What was it? Well, the Jubilee was a name given to what was in effect the first written constitution of London. It was the text that contained the rules of the reformed corporation of the city, the result of the machinations of John de Northampton. It was this book that denoted the yearly elections of aldermen. It gave the powers and the rights of the Common Council and much, much more. This was the rules of London as reformed and created in the last few years. It was beloved by many in London and hated by many others. And clearly, hating that document was Walter at Kay. The most immediate explanation as to why, in the midst of all this carnage and chaos, he wanted to destroy it was because, supposedly, it contained rules regarding the regulation of the brewer's trade. And for that reason, he wanted it destroyed. Alas, we don't know for sure. All we know that he was tearing around the city looking for it. I will come back to this book at a later chapter, but what I will say, just here and now, is if the Jubilee was not being kept in the Guild Hall, or being kept in the King's Compter, where the hell was it? But while all this was going on, believe it or not, something darker erupted. Differing mobs had now spread out across the city. One chronicle says, quote, "Then they took the heads of the Archbishop and others and put them on wooden poles and carried them before them in procession all through the city. Then they returned to London Bridge and set the head of the Archbishop above the gate with the heads of eight others they had executed, so that all who passed over the bridge could see them. This done, they went to the church of St. Martin's in the Vintry and found therein 35 Flemings, who they dragged outside and beheaded in the street." Unquote. The mob was turning on the foreigners in London. It must be stressed, as we have known from previous episodes, hatred of foreigners by Londoners was, pretty rife. We'd seen in the years previously Italian merchants being stabbed in the street, Lombards being beaten and attacked. Is it any wonder that this crowd turned on foreigners so easily? One account simply says openly, quote, "At the same time, the commons had it proclaimed that whomever could catch any Fleming or any aliens of any nation might cut off their heads. And so they did, accordingly," unquote. Now, the hatred of foreigners was not just confined to the Londoners. One of the first buildings which had been targeted by the Kentish rebels on their 13th had been a Flemish-run brothel in Southwark. And a Kentishman called Roger Boys was later at a trial in Maidstone indicted for the murder of three of the Flemings in London. But the Flemish community in London was particularly vulnerable because it was concentrated in the heart of the city, and the crowds had little difficulty in finding them on that Friday. When the rebels came across a suspected Fleming, the sources say he was asked to say bread and cheese, and if he pronounced it brunt und käse, his fate was supposedly sealed. The massacre just outside the church of St. Martin the Vintry, where they found 35 Flemings, who they just beheaded in the street, is merely the largest body of slaughter. The most prominent of the Flemings to be murdered was Sir Richard Leon, the merchant finance claim to fame had been impeached back in 1376 for his corrupt manipulation of royal debt. He met his end in Cheapside, which had become the unofficial place of execution during this last day of the uprising. But it wasn't just the Flemish who suffered. The accounts say, quote, "Then they took their way to the places of the Lombards and the other aliens and broke into their homes and robbed them of all their goods that they could discover. And so went on for all that day and night following with hideous cries and horrible tumult," unquote. This bloodbath of foreigners was targeting Italians as well. In fact, only one group of foreigners in London survived the mob as the skies began to darken, and that was London's German residents. Now, a little known fact is that the earliest eyewitness account of the peasants' revolt in London was written as quickly as the following Monday, when one of the German merchants from the Steelyard, the large compound on the riverside that was basically the embassy of the Hanse merchants, wrote a letter to the head of the Teutonic Knights back in Europe. A letter in which he says, quote, "The good people of London were prevented from protecting the foreign people, despite it being proclaimed that foreigners should not be harmed. This is why we all stayed secretly with our London friends, because we reckoned we would be protected there for so long as the bad people were in the city. This happened on the third day, and God and his beloved mother be praised that none of us have suffered a pennyworth of damage to date of this letter. And the good people of London told us they will live or die with us. Therefore, we are asking you, if you should hear people saying otherwise, you should not believe them, so that no Englishman comes to harm. We have written this letter in haste, and we are kindly requesting that you should write this to the towns in Prussia. Farewell in Christ and command us, given at London, by the aldermen and the other merchants of the Hanseatic League," unquote. Long-term listeners could remember that the Hanseatic merchants usually held very generous privileges from the crown. They paid lower customs duties. And the steelyard was actually controlled by a German alderman elected from the Germans themselves. And an English alderman was appointed by the City of London, who acted as a mediator between the Londoners and the German merchants and assisted in the resolution of any disputes. Keep in mind, the steelyard was adjacent to the site where 35 Flemings were dragged out of St. Martin in the Vintry and were beheaded. This is right in front of them. So being a German in London was especially dangerous. Who were the Londoners who saved these Germans? Well, it's probable that William Woolworth, the mayor, was one. As mayor of London, Woolworth had been appointed the English alderman of the Hounds in January that year, and consequently had a duty to assist the merchants wherein. Woolworth's own house was close to the steelyard on the site of the present Fishmongers Hall on the north side of London Bridge. And he may have concealed some of the Germans there, although, as the bridge was the scene of many of the disturbances, his house may have been a tad too exposed to be a good hiding place. However, other prominent merchants, such as Nicholas Brembe and John Philpot, had houses in Thames Street, close to the steelyard, and they may have offered some refuge to the Germans during the anarchy. Had this been why Nicholas Brembe had been willing to pay off the mob that attacked his house? Were his German friends hiding out inside? We do know that as night fell, one source of the events in London estimate that between 140 and 160 people were beheaded in and around Cheapside and across the city. London had become a place now of flowing blood and the wildness of the mob. Quote, so it went on for all that day and night following, with hideous cries and horrible tumult, unquote. Indeed, one incredibly vivid account of that Friday night describes the city in the following terms. Quote, the rebels committed these and many other enormities without sparing any grade or order, in churches and cemeteries, in roads and streets, as well as in houses and fields. Neither fearing God nor revering the honour of Mother Church, they pursued and executed all those against whom they raised their noisy cry. After a whole day spent in such detestable actions, they were at last exhausted by their labours and the drinking of so much more wine than usual. Thus, in the evening, you could see them lying scattered about on the streets and under the walls, sleeping like slaughtered pigs. That night, many of the rebels, emboldened by drink, secretly killed those of their colleagues whom they previously hated. And so there was much slaughter at the hands of one another rather than by others, unquote. It sounds like a scene from hell. What could the people of London do in the face of this absolute anarchy? Quote, they of London were in great fear of this, wherefore they kept their houses privily with their friends and such servants as they had, each man according to his puissance. And when these said people were this Friday thus somewhat appeased, and that they should depart as soon as they had their writings, every man home into his own country, then King Richard came to the royal wardrobe, where the queen his mother was, right sore afraid. So he confronted her as well as he could, and tarried there with her all that night. Unquote. Here in the midst of all of this, we finally find King Richard. The royal party had not returned to the tower on the evening of Friday the 14th, perhaps deterred by the great devastation and the grisly scenes of execution all around it, but instead had travelled to the great wardrobe, the royal wardrobe, the only fortified building under royal control left in London, a large structure of Blackfriars that contained the main financial office of the royal household. There, in the midst of all this carnage, the king spent what was doubtless a restless night. But he was not alone, because with him that evening was the mayor of London and the alderman of London. These men were the men his uncle, John of Gaunt, hated. But right now, these men were the clearest minds in the room. And while the situation outside is terrible, there were some discernible patterns. The chaos and murder now unleashed was being perpetuated by a smaller number of rebels. The mainstay of the Essex mobs were leaving or had left. As the absolute number of rebels in the city declined, so the Kentish men came to exercise a disproportionately strong influence over the direction of the revolt. This may explain why their chief, Wat Tyler, he basically only becomes the de facto leader of the London revolt from the evening of Friday the 14th of June. Indeed, this could be why he is scarcely recorded between the 12th and the 14th, and suddenly, in all the accounts, he's the star of what happens on the 15th. The fury and violence had overall been directed against the government of John of Gaunt and the royal government, and it could have turned against London's ruling class of merchants, but apart from the attack on the foreigners and a few isolated incidents we've mentioned, there was no outright onslaught of the merchant class as a whole. It was essentially, for the Londoners who were taking part, the same as the peasants, a mass rising against the royal government, not against the merchants who ruled the city. Now, as we said last chapter, the evidence certainly suggests that some aldermen, including the alderman fishmonger John Horne, along with the grocer Adam Carlyle and others, had helped steer the mob in its early directions, that they did collude with the rebels, especially in and around Southwark in the first few days. But that the events on the Friday had changed the game. Even on the Thursday, with the destruction of the Temple and Savoy, Mayor Woolworth had advocated a strong and armed response to this mob. But after the rebels had invaded the Tower, murdered the Archbishop, after the slaughter of dozens of the Flemish, the ill treatment of the Princes of Wales, Mayor Woolworth seems to have focused himself into delivering the city militia to the king to end this now. And also present with him, in all probability, with Nicholas Brembe. Now, he was not one of the aldermen that year, and therefore he had no armed contingent of men from the ward to call upon. Yet he does seem to have been there in the room advising the king. In the events of the next 24 hours, we get a distinct impression that something was being planned that night. And there was a reason for this. Another account of that terrible Friday night goes on to say, quote, "Ye may well know and believe that it was a great pity of for the danger that the king and such were with him were in. For sometimes these unhappy people shouted and cried so loud, as though all the devils of hell had been amongst them. In this evening the king was counselled by his brethren and lords, and by Woolworth, the mayor of London, and divers other notable and rich burgesses, that in the night time, at midnight, they should issue out of the Tower by four London streets and enter into the city, and so slay all those unhappy people while they were at the rest and asleep, for a thought that many of them were drunken, whereby they should be slain like flies." Unquote. Yeah, once again, for the second time, it does seem that Mayor Woolworth said, "Let's take them at night." Again, the dangers of night fighting, perhaps, stressed to the king, it was too risky to try. The concessions at Mile End had probably satisfied a good many of the rebels, but there were many more still roaming the streets and thirsting for blood. Part of the problem was that it was difficult for both the king and the rebel leaders to enforce any agreement. Possibly this meant that during the night it was agreed to arrange another meeting. A messenger, who may well have been Sir John Newton, the Constable of Rochester, was sent to find the rebel leaders, and it was agreed that King Richard would convene with them the next day at Smithfield. It was at this point that a new plan was put forward by Woolworth and the other Londoners. So what happened the next day? Do you know what? We'll never actually fully know. The much-respected historian Caroline Barron likened the scene of the confrontation between Wat Tyler and King Richard to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. There'll be no definitive reconstruction, and we end up with lots of conflicting accounts. That Saturday, we can say, the 15th, the city was still gripped with instability and carnage. Quote, "On the next day, Saturday, great numbers of the commons came into Westminster Abbey at the hour of tierce, and there they found John Imworth, Marshal of the Marshalsea and Warden of the Prisoners, a tormentor without pity. He was near the shrine of St. Edward, embracing a middle pillar, hoping for aid and succour from the saint to preserve him from his enemies. But the commons wrenched his arms away from the pillar of the shrine and dragged him into Cheap, and there beheaded him." Unquote. Now, this death is really interesting, and that entry is really interesting. It seems odd to state that a great body of rioters woke up, marched down to Westminster, avoided anything and everything to do with the state, and just turned up at Westminster Abbey to seize Imworth. What seems far more likely? Well, Imworth, because of his post, was hated by the residents of Southwark and London itself, and had not been present two nights previously when the Marshalsea had been destroyed. He'd probably fled to Westminster back then. It seems, on balance of probability, that those aligned to the aims of the rebellion discovered him in Westminster, and it was a group from within Westminster who had him seized. In fact, we know it was. Later court records clearly contradict the account we just gave, because we read that, quote, Richard Mugg of Westminster and divers other felons and traitors of the Lord King and insurgents against the Lord King and his royal subjects seized Richard de Imworth, Marshal of the Lord King, lying in his prayers in Westminster at the shrines of St. Edward's in the Church of St. Peter's Abbey. Indeed, Richard Mugg and others, by procurement, abetment, and help, feloniously and treasonably seized the aforesaid Richard Imworth on the aforesaid day, year, and place, led him out of the aforesaid church, and feloniously and treasonably killed him. Who were the others? We have a couple of names included. One was Simon Tyler. He lived over in London. And there was another called William Pitch, a London-based clerk, who was implicated in other acts of arson. The chances are that maybe they didn't drag him all the way to Cheapside, because these accounts say Imworth was killed in Westminster, just outside of the Abbey. Given, however, that it was a stronghold of the rebels, this group could have forcefully dragged the Keeper of Marshalsea back to Cheapside, but whatever the case, the crowd that grabbed him originated in Westminster. But that wasn't the only violence carrying on that Saturday morning. Quote, at the same time, they took from Bread Street a valet called John of Grenfield, merely because he had spoken well of Brother William Appleton and the other murdered persons, and they brought him into Cheap and beheaded him. All this time, the king was having it cried through the city that everyone should go peaceably to his own county and his own home, without doing more mischief. But to this, the commons would not agree, unquote. The king needed to wrest back control. Several accounts insist that that morning he finally left the wardrobe and prepared for this third encounter with meeting the rebels by seeking the intercession of his patron, St. Edward the Confessor. Early on Saturday morning, in the company of a large bodyguard, he went to the Saint's Shrine at Westminster Abbey, where his marshal had just been killed, we assume, and there, according to one source, he had a meeting with the anchorite attached to the abbey and confessed to him. Thus spiritually encouraged and fortified, he rode to Smithfield. The composition of his retinue is not known, but it seems that he accompanied by at least a couple of hundred men at arms, and according to most of the narratives, the king's party drew themselves up on the east side of the field, near the ruined priory, while the rebels, led by Wat Tyler, kept to the west side. The mid-space was left clear. King Richard ordered Mayor Woolworth to summon Tyler to come to him. Tyler rode to the king on a little horse, dismounted, half bent his knees, and then shook the king familiarly by the hand, calling him brother. Talks began. Wat Tyler and the rump of rebels seemed to have been far more radical in their demands than the guys from Essex. New demands were now laid before the king. These radicals wanted, in addition to the abolition of serfdom, an end to any man being declared an outlaw, the removal of all wealth from the church, and equality among all men below the rank of king. It has to be said, as part of his strategy just to break up the mobs, Richard conceded to these demands, saying he'd only keep the regality of his own crown. And then there was a pause, and no one said anything. And at this point, events appear to become somewhat confused. One source claims that Wat Tyler demanded a jug of water because it was so hot, and after downing it, demanded a flagon of ale, and after downing that, climbed back onto his horse. At this point, an esquire of the king insulted Wat Tyler. Tyler rounded on the esquire, and William Woolworth retaliated by trying to arrest him. Tyler lunged at the mayor with his dagger, but missed or stabbed him, and the mayor's armour turned to one side, and the mayor in turn struck Tyler, injuring him on the shoulder. Bleeding badly, Tyler rode part of the way across the square, then collapsed to the ground within sight of his men. Other sources agree that a scuffle broke out, but disagree as to why and what happened. One says that Wat Tyler provoked the incident, that he demanded a dagger that was in the possession of one of the king's squires, and when the latter refused to hand it over, he became threatening. At this point, Woolworth came forward with some of the guards and rounded on him. He knocked Tyler to the ground, and an esquire called Ralph Standish finished off the rebel. Other sources claim the rebel leader was killed by several sword thrusts into the body. Historical schools of thought tend to break into three camps around now. For some, this entire row was caused by Wat Tyler, basically being an ass. Others, that the king and his party had turned up intending to kill the rebel leader all along. And the third group say that, well, what happened was just misadventure. Literally, in this debate, you pick a side of one of those and allow those who oppose you present well-argued cases against you. As such, me, I tend to favour the second and third group coming together. I do believe that the King and the Aldermen of London had come up with a plan to end the struggle here and now, and that the radical Wat Tyler was to be taken out. But I also believe that what was planned and what happened is the difference between having an idea and then being forced to improvise to make it happen based on circumstances. Why do I believe that? Well, one account says that at the moment Wat Tyler fell, the King's men surrounded him. Now, it sure seems to me that the King's party had come with a clear idea in mind. They knew that the rebel leader had to be seized and taken out, and his followers on the other side of the square had to be prevented from catching sight of this happening. So that's the first reason why I believe there was a plan. And the second reason was London was clearly expecting this to happen. All the chronicles agree that when Wat Tyler was struck down and killed, the Londoners were quickly on hand to act and seize the momentum. Mayor Woolworth rode, quote, hastily to the city, unquote. Word was spread as to what had happened, and in no time, well-armed levies from the wards were pouring out. Remember, we'd mentioned them and even mentioned a chapter of these. These were men armed in red and white liveries and carrying axes. Another source says that this group of Londoners enveloped the rebels, quote, like sheep in a pen, unquote. All the signs are that there was a well-organised strategy being put into effect. If a guess had to be made as to the authors of the plan, I'd say the likeliest candidates were Mayor Woolworth and Sir Robert Knowles. The former had long advocated tough action, while the latter was a soldier of some experience. And significantly, one source says that Robert Knowles had brought his own retinue to the field with him, and they were very keen to tear into the rebels. Richard's own role in the unfolding of this drama, of course, is pretty well documented. A few of the sources said that when Tyler was slain, the young king spurred his horse and rode into the rebel midst. Waving his arm, he cried, "You shall have no captain but me. Just follow me to the fields without, and there you can have what you want," unquote. Apparently, he pushed his way beyond the melee where Tyler was being taken out. And while the crowd panicked and didn't know what to do, the king's bravery at this moment reminded them that he's their leader, and they started to move. The impact of the king does seem to have been a deciding factor. Virtually all the writers of the time do stress the bravery of the teenage boy at this exact moment, single-handedly facing off against a body of rebels who had murderously left a trail of destruction across the southeast of England. And those who don't believe that there was a master plan going on do point out that if there had been a master plan, the entire operation would not have been approved, because you can't have a plan where the most crucial part of it is that the king risks his life by riding alone into a bunch of, well, revolutionaries. But this is where I believe improvisation took over. This was the third meeting with the rebels that the king had held. And this group, or the core of this group, he'd last seen only a few days previously as he stood on a boat over in Greenwich. And back then, as he'd seen yesterday, the rebels had just wanted to meet him. The awe of majesty Richard had seen in Mile End the day before was apparent here. So while the king was taking a risk, it was a calculated one. Maybe he believed that the crowd would obey him, that he was giving them all they wanted. Sure, it's a reckless and dumb move, but maybe in the heat of the moment, it's a kind of thing an impetuous 14-year-old would do. And it is worth saying once again that Richard was doing this as part of a larger strategy. The king's aim all along was simply to get the rebels moving as quickly as possible away from London. With the king again reminding them, "I'm on your side, I will set you free," the crowd began cheering, and he sent an order to them to assemble their company to the north, away from London and Clerkenwell. Now, contrary to what's implied, he did not ride leading these men himself. Sources said he made his own way by a different route, nor does it seem he made the journey unprotected. He was accompanied by Mayor Woolworth, who'd returned from the city, and with a retinue of knights, and I well imagine a bunch of heavily armed London lads with axes. And when the rebels had reassembled away from where Wat Tyler was quietly being shivved and disposed of, Richard confirmed the terms he'd agreed the day before at Mile End. He was telling them they had won. He was going to give them charters saying this. He was going to give them mercy. Shortly after this, the last body of rebels began to break up. Indeed, several had already fled. According to one source, Richard detached a couple of knights from his retinue to lead the Kentish men away. The knights took them through London and then over the bridge, quote, "so that each might go peacefully to his home," unquote. The king had won. But it is worth remembering, the king's victory was reinforced by London's force of arms. A force led, quote, "by the mayor himself, who had gone into the city at the instance of Olaf the king, in the space of half an hour sent and led forth therefrom so great a force of citizen warriors in aid of his lord the king, that the whole multitude of madmen were surrounded and hemmed in. Not one of them would have escaped if our lord the king had not given orders to allow them depart. Therefore our lord the king returned into the city of London with the greatest of glory and honour, and the whole of this profane multitude in confusion fled forthwith from concealment in their affright. For this same deed our lord the king, beneath his standard in the same field, and with his own hands decorated with order of knighthood, the said mayor, and Sir Nicholas Brembe, and Sir John Philpot, who had already been mayors of said city, and also Sir Robert Land," unquote. The revolt was over. The merchants of London were the heroes of the hour. And now London was going to have to deal with one hell of an aftermath. Thanks for listening. That's it. We're all done. Peasants' revolt finished. Quite a lot in there. I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you could follow along. I'll be back again next week as we carry on with the aftermath and we start exploring more about this amazing text called the Jubilee. Thanks for listening. I'll see you then. Bye.